Welcome to Radio Aldi, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Welcome to Radio Aldi. I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and today I'm going to be talking to someone with one of the most instantly recognisable and distinctive voices on radio and television. Pam Ayres is a much-loved poet, comedian, songwriter and broadcaster. Ever since she took part in Opportunity Knocks in 1975 and practically broke the clapometer, she's been a presence on our screens, airwaves and the stage. She even performed her one-woman show for the Queen, and in 2004 she was awarded an MBE for services to literature and entertainment. Pam Ayres, a very warm welcome to Radio Aldi.
Thank you, Charlotte. It's very nice to be here. Thank you. I'm not sure I did break the clapometer. I remember being quite sure that there wasn't somebody around the back sort of holding the needle of the clock, but it certainly raised a few laughs.
Well, since we started there, why don't we start there? Well, I was going to go back a bit, but as we're there, that was in 1975, was it, that you went off? 74? No.
It was 1975. I was on BBC Radio Oxford for a year or so beforehand. They were lovely to me. They gave me a weekly spot and a nice long lead time because I was afraid of deadlines. And they were very supportive when I had no confidence at all. And then I went on Opportunity Knocks I think it was November 1975, the programme. And I did that because at home, I was gathering speed. I hated my job. I was a shorthand typist I was a secretary to the works engineer. I was supposed to be a confidential secretary, which was the top grade of secretary, but I was so bored. So I didn't like it. I wasn't happy. And I took part in a charity show in Bampton, in the village of Bampton, which did a big charity show every Christmas for the senior citizens for their Christmas dinner. And it had gone extremely well. It was an Edwardian type music hall do, and I got all dressed up in a big hat with grapes and parrots and God knows what on. And it had gone really well, and people had fallen about laughing. And the organiser said to me at the end, "We want to put you up for Opportunity Knocks." And I thought, well, I hate my job. I got nothing to lose, really. And so I went along with it, thinking that nothing would come of it. And so you had to fill in a form saying what you did. And I said, writer and reciter of humorous verse, and sent that off, expecting never to hear a word. And I was invited back for an audition in Birmingham in some mouldering ballroom of a mouldering hotel. And I did a couple of my poems, and they asked me to stay behind. They fell over themselves. He said to me, who writes this? I said, I do. And he said, well, you're certainly on the programme. Said, and if any other television companies approach you, you should get in touch with us straight away. You know, I felt like a real hot property.
Well, you were.
I didn't feel like one, but it was great. Well, what they liked about me was that I was doing something different, and as such, I was to be prized.
And what did you read? What did you, or recite, rather, on Opportunity Knocks?
On Opportunity Knocks? I think I started off... Well, yes, I started off with I Wish I Looked After Me Teeth. And then I was on a few programmes, and I would have done The Battery Hen. And the ones... I didn't have many that I'd written. The Battery Hen I would have done. I Wish I Looked After Me Teeth. I had one about having a cold. I only had about eight at that stage.
What's the first one you wrote?
The first one I wrote was a parody on a Lonnie Donegan song called The Big Grand Coulee Dam, which was the B-side of one of Lonnie Donegan's greatest hits, like My Old Man's a Dustman or Does Your Chewing Gum Lose Its Flavour on the Bedpost Overnight? Because I had four lovely brothers, and they would bring home all the popular music of the day and play it on our old Dansette record player. So they brought home Lonnie Donegan's, they were two big hits for Lonnie Donegan, My Old Man's a Dustman, and Does Your Chewing Gum Lose Its Flavour on the Bedpost Overnight. And on the backside, the B-side of one of those records, was a song called The Big Grand Coulee Dam, which was an American song, a folk song, a country sort of song. And I wrote a parody of it called Rosie Bell, Who Chanced to Wander from the Straight and Narrow when I was 12. And that was the first time I remember trying to write something funny to make people laugh.
Ah, but you'd started performing by then as a child, because you...
Well, only in the school play, you know, if they were having a school play, I wanted to be in it and saying something funny if possible. And then when I left school, I joined various drama clubs and theatre groups. You know, I just liked being on stage. I liked writing. I loved writing. I loved the power it gives you to invent situations and people and control events. It's thrilling. And I loved being on stage and hearing people laugh. But it was a long time before I put the two things together that I realised I could perhaps write my own material, use my own love of writing and my own timing and my own crackpot accent, and, you know, try and combine all those things to something that I could say. Then it wasn't until I was 19 and in the Air Force in Singapore, and I belonged to a theatre club there, and I started to write things that I could perform, because we had a club night on Friday nights when people would get up on the stage.
What did you do in the Air Force?
I was a plotter of aerial photography, and I wasn't very good at it.
Your memoir had the most amazing title, which I've now, of course, forgotten, which was... Oh, what was it?
It's called The Necessary Aptitude.
Yes, because you were told you didn't have it.
Yeah, in all my early jobs, yes. People kept saying, I'm afraid you haven't got the necessary aptitude for the job. You know, when I was in the civil service when I left school at 15, and I had to fill in identical forms all day long, and it was mind-numbingly boring,
yes.
And I mucked about... I mucked about and didn't concentrate and was a pain in the neck. And so they told me I didn't have the necessary aptitude for the job. And then I went into the accounts department. Well, I was hopeless at that as well, because it was a what they called a national cash machine, which was like a whopping great typewriter. And you had to put these enormous cards in. And then if you press the right keys, it processed the mathematics. And of course, I couldn't do that. Well, it was a disaster, and I was told I didn't have the necessary aptitude for that. And then, excuse me, I went into the Air Force, and I was misplaced as an aerial photography plotter because I made the mistake. Well, it wasn't really a mistake, but I told the recruiting sergeant in Reading that I like drawing, because I do. I like drawing. I'm not a bad amateur artist. And he said, oh, well, we'll put you in a drawing office. And I was such a duffer, I didn't sort of think, well, that doesn't sound quite like the same kind of drawing that I enjoy. And then the security was quite intense because you were sort of dealing with sensitive photography. And once they had cleared you for security, they wouldn't let you change trades. And I'd signed on for 4 years, which was the minimum. And so I was stuck with a job I didn't like and couldn't really do, because it was all maths and the scale of photography and focal lengths and how high the aircraft was above the ground. And I mean, my eyes spun in opposite directions, to be honest. I couldn't do it. But the good thing was, because I couldn't do it, I belonged to a theatre club in Singapore, the RAF Theatre Club. And so I always seemed to have a part in the current play, and so I'd just spend my time learning the part, you know, and getting it as good as I could, and writing things that I could perform for the club nights.
So you got out of the Air Force when, and then what did you do?
Yeah, well, the minimum you could sign on for was 4 years, and I don't regret it, because although I was in completely the wrong trade, the travel was magical, because I was a duffer, really, a country girl from a rural village. I'd never really been anywhere. I'd been to Skegness, to Butlins with my friends, and that was about it. And to suddenly find myself in the Far East and everything that that represented, the architecture and the culture and the food and the language and the mixture of Malaysian, Chinese, Indian people. I mean, it was a real eye-opener.
So you came back when?
When I was 21, I came home. And then I was posted back to Brampton for a while, and then I left in 69. And then I just kicked about, really. I got a job at Morris Radiators in Oxford as a sort of typist. I didn't like it. And then I got a job at Smith's Industries in Whitney as a shorthand typist. Clawed my way up the ladder to confidential secretary. I didn't like any of those jobs. But the thing that saved me was the folk clubs, because at that time in the 70s, a great rash of folk clubs were appearing in all the pubs. And I don't know why that came about, but it did. And anybody who had a pub out in the sticks where I lived, if they had a slow night on a Tuesday or a Thursday, they could declare it a folk night, you know. And I used to go to one in Ducklington near Whitney, one in Chipping Norton, lots of folk clubs, and you could get up and sing. And for me, I could try out my poems and hope that, you know, if I learned them, that I could write something that made people laugh. So it was a really good training ground, a friendly training ground. And at the same time, Billy Connolly was doing the same thing around the folk club. So was Max Boyce, Jasper Carrot, Mike Harding. We were all working around the folk clubs. I just love the idea of people making their own entertainment, and that was the epitome of it, really. You could go along, get yourself a glass of cider, and then join in all the choruses, because everybody knew the songs. It was great fun. You made good friends. And then there'd be floor singers, which I started off as, and I used to play my guitar, my mum's ukulele, and throw in a poem here and there. And then BBC Radio Oxford came round recording one night, and they liked me. And they asked me to go on to BBC Radio Oxford, and it went from there, really. The first poem I did that was broadcast on Radio Oxford was The Battery Hen, and that's a sort of lament from a poor old bird that's shut up in a cage. I mean, it's ever so old now, and I wouldn't...
Ever so sad!
I know, I mean, I wouldn't make... It's sort of a bit... It's not meant to be mocking, but it sounds a bit mocking. And I so hate battery farms, even though now they're supposed to be enriched and the poor old bird's got a few extra inches. They're still confined in these horrible cages. But yes, I did The Battery Hen on Radio Oxford, and it had an astonishing reaction. It was picked up by Pick of the Week, which I'd never heard of. Somebody rang me at work and said, "Your poem is on Pick of the Week." What? Didn't know what it was. I never listened to Radio 4. And then it was picked up by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and Broadcasting Canada. So it had an extraordinary initial reaction, and that bolstered BBC Radio Oxford to ask me to come on and do a weekly poem. And I was terrified. I said, I've never written to a deadline. I don't know if I can do it. And Andy Wright, who was looking after me there, he said, "We'll give you 6 months, you know, come back in 6 months, see what you can do." And that wasn't scary, 6 months. So BBC Radio Oxford did it all right. They were nice.
At what point were you able to leave all these jobs that you didn't like?
I left my job at Smith's Industries on Friday the 13th of February, 1976.
Because it was a memorable day.
Yeah, it was, because I had been offered a television advert for cheese, for cream cheese, for which I was paid £600, and that was a fortune.
In those days, yeah.
That was a fortune. Mm. I was earning about £25 a week then as a secretary, and I was offered £600 to go to write a verse about this cheese and go and perform it on telly. And that was the moment when I thought, this is it, you know, you burn your bridges. Yeah. I thought £600, my rent and my little bedsitter was £5 a week. So I thought, I can live for a long time on that 600 quid, be a flipping fortune. And so I did the advert, and then I hoped that I would be able to find some kind of employment, which I did.
What did your parents say about you sort of abandoning your what they would consider to be a safe job?
No, Dad wasn't impressed at all. Nobody knew what to make of it, really. After I won Opportunity Knocks, I remember Mum saying, "You've made it, old girl," she said.
Oh, bless her.
I know, it was so sweet. And I think they thought that sort of I'd just gone into some different sphere, you know, of activity where normal standards didn't apply and you didn't necessarily have to stick at your old job. If people were offering you £600 to be on the telly, you know, I was suddenly a person on TV, and then so they didn't feel that they could advise me.
You're one of six, aren't you? So do any of your brothers or sisters have this talent, or what do they all do and what do they all think about it?
Sadly, I've only got one brother left now because I'm the youngest. They all had trades, you know. My brother Tony was electrician. My brother Rog was electrician outside, you know, up the power lines, shinning up there. My brother Alan was a builder, and my brother Jeff was... he worked for the council as a sort of gardener, really, maintenance. So they were all in ordinary jobs. My sister Jean longed for a family. She was desperate to have a family, and she was a full-time mum. Prior to that, she worked in the supermarket, and she worked at Smith's Industries for a while as well in the factory. We just had ordinary jobs. We were a very ordinary family, but I wanted something else. I felt as though I wasn't supposed to do that. I don't know why I got that feeling, but I used to write all the time. I'd come home from my various boring jobs and just write things.
I think when I heard you on Desert Island District, it was quite a long time ago, but you said you were spurred on by Bob Dylan.
I did like Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
And my dad was very controlling. Particularly to my sister. My sister sort of broke down the barriers a lot because she was older than me, but she wasn't allowed to go out to dances or anything much that you want to do when you're that age. But Dad was very strict. And suddenly Bob Dylan was on the scene singing Times They Are A-Changing. Mm. You know, your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Get out of the way if you can't lend a hand. I mean, it was heady stuff.
Yeah.
I loved it, as many, many people did. I found him a voice that applied to me. And when I listened to him, it made me want to write my own things.
What's been your most, your favourite part of performing? Was it your one-woman show?
You can't separate various parts, really. The whole thing is enmeshed, mm-hmm. so that I've just written a poem called I'll Have to Send Them Back, which is about online shopping. And I got that idea because I sent away for some shoes and they're absolutely useless and I had to send them back. And so it's getting that idea. It's identifying a situation that other people will identify with. I don't want to write about rarefied things. I want to write about things that will make people say, yeah, I felt like that myself. So I learn it, and then I go out and I deliver it to the best of my ability, and I hope that I will get my reward, which is a laugh, because I don't want to read to an audience. I don't want to put my glasses on and open a book and stand at a lectern, because it's not the same.
No.
It's not the same as looking people in the eye and giving it to them straight, you know. And it's worth taking the trouble to do that. Because I see performers reading from an iPhone, you know, and there's no contact,
no
eye contact.
No. I think what's really interesting is you said, it's, and this is well known that you've said this, that you don't want to provoke thought or be profound. You just, your reward is that laugh. But you do have this incredible, I mean, your tooth poem is just brilliant. I mean, anybody who's ever had a filling or any dentist, you know, who's ever opened their mouth in a dentist room will relate to it, because everyone hates a dentist. You know, having nice dentist is, I mean, it's not nothing anybody looks forward to.
The drill in the marrow of your teeth, I know, it's not something to look forward to. Well, yeah, I mean, because I do a one-woman show, you cannot try and have a succession of hilariously funny pieces one after the other. You have to introduce light and shade, because it's a presumptuous thing to do, to say, I am going to entertain you on my own with no music for 2 hours. And so I put together a programme of new things, old things, funny things, sad things, you know, so that it keeps people on their toes in a way.
What did you do for the Queen when you did it for the Queen? What did you do for
I didn't know what to do for the Queen. I was a speaker at a reception which was staged because they were joining two Forces charities. Oh. I think it was something like Forces Help and SAFA or something were coming together. I may have those wrong, but they were Forces charities that were amalgamating, and there was a reception in connection with that, and I was a speaker. So there were two rows of chairs and a little stage. So, you know, I was like 10 feet from the Queen. One of the chairs was particularly gilded, you know. And so I didn't know. I've spoken for the Queen twice, once there and once in Sandringham. The first time I talked about my father's knitted swimming costume, because I thought she was of a sort of era that would recognise that. Because Dad had this awful old knitted swimming costume that used to drop once it got wet.
It dropped. That's worse.
With this awful white knicker elastic round the waist. I mean, it was horrendous. So I did that, and I was so nervous because I didn't dare look at the Queen in case she was looking at her watch or yawning or something. But I think it went really well. And afterwards, the lady in waiting came up to me and said, "The Queen rocked," she said. So that was nice. And then the next time I did a speech for the Queen was in Sandringham for the Women's Institute. And I thought then, because Dudley and I had two teenage sons at that time, I thought I would talk about how much they ate, about how much they came home, opened the fridge. No, next day there'd be nothing in it. You'd go out and do a big shop. They'd come home and a couple of days later the fridge was empty. And so I talked about that. And afterwards the Queen said, "Oh, it's just the same with William and Harry." So that was nice, you know. She said, "Oh, they eat us out of house and home," she said.
That
was sweet, yeah.
Oh, how nice. So what now?
One of the lovely things I've been doing, which started in 2019, was writing songs. Because a young man called Louis Mander, a music teacher in the local school, came along and said, "Would I write the words to a school's version of Peter Pan?" And I loved it. I really loved writing for a crocodile and a mermaid and Tinkerbell and the horrible Captain Hook. Not to be Pam Ayres, but to actually be somebody, write for somebody else. And then for somebody who has musical skill to lift it with music, I found it was thrilling. And through a musical that my husband is putting together, I met George Fenton, who wrote all the lovely, you know,
Film Blue scores Planet.
Yeah. Mm. So I met George, and we really get on very well. And I had written a book called Who Are You Calling Vermin, which is about undercurrents in the countryside. It's not a rosy view of the countryside at all. It's about people who are hard up and animals who are trapped and poisoned and about. If you really live in the country like I do, you're aware that it isn't a rosy scene necessarily. And George and I have put together a musical version of Who Are You Calling Vermin, and we've done three performances of it with a great band. And George has written all this wonderful music. And it's so thrilling to me because I can do so much with words. I can do a lot with words. But then when you get somebody really skilled like George to apply music of all different types to the songs, it's been wonderful. It's been a wonderful departure. And it's been responsible for the fact that I'm currently at my late stage in life learning to play the piano.
Oh, good for you.
Very haltingly.
Where have these performances been, and when's the next one? Tell our listeners.
I don't know when we're going to do the next one because we need to do some development work on it. But we have done the performance in the Basingstoke Anvil Theatre, the Story House in Peterborough, and Barnes in the old sorting office in Barnes.
Fantastic.
And it's so thrilling to have proper singers singing my words because I can't sing. And I don't really like hearing other people read my poems. I don't say that in a nasty way, but I feel as though I can get a lot out of the poems with a pause or a shifty look or a, you know...
comic timing, you've got the right timing.
If I hear other people reading my poems, I don't find it very uplifting. I want to say, you've said it all wrong, you know, you've got right. it all wrong.
I probably have, yeah.
But the songs are different, because I can't sing, so I love hearing people sing my words, sing them properly. Mm. And we've had the young man who played one of the parts in my show, Vermin, is currently playing the lead in The Lion King. So we have really top people, because George has all these wonderful contacts. And that's been amazing to me, and thrilling to work with somebody like George, because I've always been a one-man band. And then suddenly I was working in conjunction with somebody really, really ingenious. So that's been a lovely new departure.
And so this your latest poem, can we end, do you think, by hearing
absolutely
that?
Absolutely.
Very relevant to Christmas. Whether we're listening to this before or after Christmas, who knows? But sending stuff back, I'm sure
we'll all be doing it after Christmas, won't we? Actually, I've got two little Christmassy pieces. One is because our first son was born on December the 12th, so it was all very Christmassy when he was born. And I was so thrilled with him. He was a lovely baby. He was a lovely, plump little baby with a bit of hair.
How old is he now?
He's 42 now. But this is what I wrote when I first had him. And it's because when I looked at other people's babies, I had uncharitable thoughts. My baby's eyes are bluer than yours. He's got much more hair and he's stronger. He's ever so bright and he sleeps through the night. And of our two, I'd say mine is longer. I swear it's the truth. Mine is cut in a tooth, and he's obviously going to be tall. So it's hard to explain now I've looked at your Wayne, why you bothered to have one at all.
But I think that is every mother's thing.
I know.
We look back at our babies and think, what were we thinking? They weren't that gorgeous, but we thought they were at the time.
So poor old Wayne. And the other one that you mentioned is this one. And I don't like the fact that we all have to shop online now, and you go into the shops and they haven't got much stock. No. And they say, oh, you can find it online.
It's so annoying.
Well,
isn't
you mean? Can't yes. feel it. You can't try it on and see if it hangs on you like a sack. You don't find that out until it turns up days later. And then you have all the palaver of sending it back. Those shoes, they look so beautiful, so stylish and refined. A little motif on the front, a shapely heel behind. I ordered them and waited for the courier to call. Delivery was swift, he threw them straight across the wall. Through the air they travelled and they landed with a thud. Thanks a lot, I shouted and retrieved them from the mud. But the parcel had arrived, and that had blown away the blues. For what is more uplifting than a nice new pair of shoes? Or wrapped in tissue paper, white as snow, the footwear lay. I picked them up admiringly and turned them every way. I placed them on the carpet, and with luxury they shone. But having these gigantic feet, I couldn't get them on. I'll have to send them back. I'll have to send them back. The ruddy things are useless. I'll have to send them back. Down the post office, I'll be glaring at the clock, standing in a queue that's going halfway round the block. Oh, I'm done with online shopping. It's just a loser's game. The goods all look enticing, but they go back just the same. Although, that is a lovely dress before me on the screen. I need one for a wedding, and that's the nicest one I've seen. Oh, I could cut a dash in that. I'd be dressed to kill. The model's only 17 and beautiful, but still. Where'd I put my credit card? My little plastic friend. Next day delivery. That'll do it. Send.
Oh, that's brilliant. And listeners, I have to tell you, I have been lucky enough to have had the full on performance.
Yeah, well, I'll have to send it back. Oh, thank you.
Oh, that's going to resonate with every single oldie.
I know, it does. It does strike a chord, especially the courier. And when I do the courier, the delivery was swift. He threw it straight across the wall. I do this sort of throwing like they do because they check things over our wall. And I ordered some wildlife boxes, some little mousy boxes that are made of a material called woodcrete, which is a mixture of concrete and wood shavings for strength and warmth. And it's and all over it. So do not throw, do not throw. And this moron threw them straight across the wall. They were all broken to bits.
Oh, no.
I mean, they did replace them, but, you know, it's a palaver. And yeah. So that line about delivery was swift, he threw them straight across the wall. It gets such a laugh because everybody can envisage failures in delivery, whether it's leaving it on the doorstep and somebody pinches it or whether it gets chucked over the wall and broken. It's never very satisfactory.
No, but that is your genius. You turn those moments of frustration we all have into something absolutely hilarious.
Oh, thank you.
Anyway, I really enjoyed that.
No, it's lovely. Thank you for your interesting questions.
Well, we loved having you. Thank you so much, Pam. You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with Pam Ayres. If you enjoyed listening to us and would like to hear more like this, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. My very, very warm thanks again to you, Pam, at the end of a long day for coming here and making me laugh.
I enjoyed it. I had a very nice cup of coffee.
And my thanks to you, Bailey Gifford, for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.